Tuesday, the 13th of December in the year of our Lord, 1988. And we had slipped you into All Souls, in fact, and we were talking about philosophy in All Souls. We were talking about some of your intellectual influences that shaped you. We're now in the early 1930s, but we had not talked about how you were elected to All Souls, and to the degree that that is something that I should know about.
Yes, yes,
you should tell me about that.
Walter, it wasn't in the exceptional. The point was this. I'd done these two final schools. I got my bad first in grades and my quite rather good first in PPE year after. My tutor was a man called Frank Hardy, who was a very, very honorable Scottish philosophy tutor of great meticulousness and vehement of unimpeachable integrity and a very good tutor, suggested I might go to All Souls. I didn't know what that meant. But I didn't know. I was, by this time, came to New College as a lecturer. I'd lived in New College from about September 1932 onwards. There's no gap between being an undergraduate, and being a don. It's straightforward. Mm-hmm. I began teaching 2 months after, taking that in those days. There's no BPhil, there were none of these intermediate examinations.
Yes.
Which now,
yes.
Okay. Well, I loathed New College then. Absolutely hated it. The only people I could talk to, the common was dreary beyond words.
What about the teaching?
Teaching was all right. I quite enjoyed it. Mm. But the pupils, I talked lively philosophy to them, they talked lively philosophy to me, that was okay.
But did you say to yourself, aha, I've discovered I'm a teacher? I mean, did you have a sense of vocation?
No. I just wanted to talk about philosophy, as might be to anybody else who read a paper to me and has a lecture and they want to argue.
Right.
Or was it right, was it wrong, what was it? Right. No. I didn't feel studies of vocation as a teacher, nor did I feel this is a change of life.
Mm-hmm. You just float seamlessly.
Just very much, I'm afraid, right. As far as I remember. I didn't say to myself, I was very pleased to be given the job because there was nothing else I could do.
Yes.
I was given the job because Crossman, I think I told you that, who appointed me, mm-hmm. wasn't really interested in philosophy. He was a marvelous tutor. He was lively, he was provocative, he excited people. But philosophy is slightly boring. And above all, pedantic aspect, he thought. He thought I was a quiet hack, would sit in the back room, quite correctly, and I would do all the sort of necessary preparation of the students were done by me.
Yeah.
While he went about exciting them and preaching to them and delivering exciting lectures, Germany, Plato, Germany, fascism,
yeah.
And that kind of thing, you see,
yeah.
Which he did. He did excite them, particularly Rhodes scholars, who were tremendously uplifted by him, because he was unlike an ordinary tutor, and he used to pucker his face, his eyebrows, large eyebrows suddenly came lowered, and he would then more or less bully them, shout at them, they liked it. Well, he was a personality of the first order, but he was not an intellectual, fundamentally. Well-trained alchemist, knew a lot of Greek, read Plato very well, knew Plato, knew Aristotle, extremely well trained, accurate, all that, only interested in influencing people.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you see, whereas I was, all my life, I've always pathologically avoided trying to influence people. So to influence anybody is to me a source of horror. I did not be involved.
Now, Isaiah,
true.
You love influence. Isn't that
not
a little self-deceiving?
No. If someone says he's greatly influenced by you, I have a start.
Why?
Because I don't want responsibility.
No.
Just for that reason. I don't want responsibility for other people's lives at all. I mean, maybe selfish if you like. But the point is, I don't want to be involved. I want to extricate myself.
Right.
The thought that someone is doing something because of me fills me with guilt and anxiety and responsibility. That's all. It isn't...
Well, but you see, you told me before we began recording.
I don't.
Little,
I have.
A nice
I've never
story of sitting on a railway platform in 1946 with what I think was the Vice Chancellor,
yes.
Oscar, and whispering in his ear two proposals for an honorary
yes,
degree: one
right.
Pasternak, the other De Gaulle.
Correct.
You didn't win, but
no.
That's also how I see you.
No, but
whispering discreetly into the coulisses.
Not discreetly. Quite openly. Quite loudly. Quite loudly on the platform. I said, "I've just come to Moscow." No. In Moscow,
yes.
There's somebody there, I think, perhaps. He said, who? I had to spell the name, how could he know?
But that's a kind of influence to get back to our theme.
No, persuading people. Oh, I'm quite good at that. And I try that. No, no. When I say influence, I mean I've never had disciples in my life. Never. No such persons. You see? But given how long I've lived and how much I've talked, you might think it's rather odd, but that's part of the thing.
And that you prefer?
Yes.
Right.
You see? I've never met anybody who regards himself as a disciple of mine.
Right.
Unlike people who like disciples.
Of whom Crossman would be one.
Crossman, very much, but not intellectual disciples, but political, emotional, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Crossman, you see, the habit was to make young men attached to him. And when he no longer liked them, dropped them over enormous cliffs. Suddenly lost interest.
Yes.
And sometimes they were ruined by it.
Yes.
Not permanently. At least for time.
Do you feel you were ever the disciple of anyone else?
Yes, I was a disciple of my tutor in Corpus. And whenever I went to a philosophical meeting, all the arguments on both sides appeared to me entirely convincing. I hardly spoke, because each seemed to... I was never said, no, that isn't so. I hardly ever spoke, because it appeared to me that what everybody said had a lot of truth. This is not a very good thing for anyone who's more polemical. The pupils are different. Them I really did take to pieces. Some of them did complain that I left them in ruins. Because I was overcritical.
Yes.
That certainly happened. But at philosophical societies, dons always appeared to me to be much cleverer than me.
Yes.
No more, argue much better.
Yes.
Always. That remains.
Would it be possible to describe yourself as a disciple of Austin at any time?
Yes, you could say that. I mean, in the sense that he had certainly had an influence on conversations with him. Taught me a great deal. So, you're about the only one. I can't think of anyone else in Oxford of whom this can be said. Certainly none of the others.
Okay, let's get
and
back.
And now get back to Mill's Hills,
yes.
Well, I went to this common room, which was boring, dreary, and pompous. It's the first time young men learn they can't say what they like saying because people are too shocked and they're too conventional.
Mm.
People talk about bypasses, people talked about cars, people talked about I don't know what they read in newspapers. It was impossible to say anything genuine.
Yes.
There I was in September. The only people I could talk to were Crossman, who was a bully, but were called to talk to. First time I dined there, he said to me, I couldn't speak at all, I was so shy. And I still am in wrong company, I don't speak. He said, be bright, Berlin, be bright. If you aren't, they won't take you, you know. That did not increase my confidence. Very typical. Then there was a man called Christopher Cox, with great charm, was an ancient historian, who afterwards went to the colonial office, as some educational authority. And there was a man called Casson, who was a kind of archaeologist, who was a sort of jester. A great old talk to, but not worth it. And who else? And Smith, who was a philosopher, was a man of some charm, whom I could chat to in a kind of formal way. Apart from them, and I hesitate to say it, considering who was still alive, who was in the common room at that time, like, say, Henry Phelps Brown, the economist, you see?
Yes.
Who was there, said, certainly, or, I don't know, Harold Wilson came later. But anyway, I was very, not only bored, but depressed by it. I went through a very melancholy period. My friend Maurice Barrows, who I had met rather only the year before, but who did rather exhilarate me, was gone. On a sabbatical year. So then I went to Thrall's Hills rather mechanically. But when I was elected, the relief was enormous. I left New College with the greatest possible relief. And suddenly went to Thrall's Hills. Everyone was young and bright and talkative, and all the old men had to be on their toes before the young men because the disproportion was enormous. And there I talked for 2 days and two nights, non-stop, then fell ill. Had been taken away for about 2 months with sinusitis and various diseases. Totally exhausted. Now also, I had some friends. One of my friends was Douglas Jay, who I'd met somewhere. Then I knew Garon Muris, a notorious figure, who was a year younger, older than he was the same age as me, but was elected the year before. And I just knew John Sparrow, because I was an editor of a highbrow magazine, as I told you, Oxford Outlook, and I invited him to write an article against William Empson, who was his contemporary at Winchester. They knew each other. There was an altercation between them. It's quite amusing to read even now. And I'd called on him, you know, also. And then I remember the night before my examination, my second examination, I went to dinner in Christchurch with Freddie Eyre, my friend, and there was Maurice Barra, John Sparrow, my friend Martin Cooper, the musical critic and contemporary of mine, who I don't know, Roy Harrod, whom I just knew, and so on. And there was a very gay, lively, intellectual dinner party, and Garon Maurice was there. So, and Sparrow was there, and I talked to him at great length, and got on with him. So I knew three fellows, but that wasn't in itself probably in the whole of it, very junior then. No Jews had been made fellows and tutors of colleges, except one before me, you know. That was I'm telling you, that was Professor Samuel Alexander from Melbourne, who I think became a fellow of Lincoln in the 1890s. I doubt if they knew he was a Jew when they elected him. He was called Samuel Alexander, Melbourne. Probably the people who wrote letters about him didn't say it. Number of Jews in Australia at that time cannot have been great. The suspicion he might, he was a perfectly identified Jew. No, no, I mean, he became a Zionist and all kinds of things. He wrote a book on Spinoza, Australian philosophy is still influenced by him. Yes. There's a man, a famous guy in Melbourne, what's he called? The anti-Wittgenstein man, pardon me, the great influence on all Australian philosophers. He was a Freudian and a communist, and you probably heard his name. He was a Freudian and a communist and an original figure, and Proust, and everything was taught by him. Anderson.
No,
there was a man called Anderson, Andersonians. But a famous Australian school philosopher still.
In turn descended from Alexander.
Yeah, well, only because he read Alexander. Alexander was in England. But maybe because he was Australian. Anderson took an interest and became a disciple.
And you were the first Jew?
After Alexander. Alexander left for Manchester. Yeah. In the 90s, or 1902, or 3, he became quite famous. He got the OM. He was a sort of well-known philosopher with a beard. And very noble, holy, nice, a distinguished man, not much good. In my opinion, it's philosophy, but never mind about that. You see, but it's an honored figure, friend of Whitehead. That sort of figure, do you see? Well, then the next Jew to be made a fellow, let me tell you a story, Jews in Oxford. The first Jew to be made a fellow at all was a mathematician of great talent in Cambridge, called Sylvester. He could not become a fellow of a college because of the religious tests, which were only admitted Anglicans. To the universities. There were no Catholics, no reformers. Then religious tests were abolished. Oxford and Cambridge, I should think in the, probably by Gladstone, I should think in the early 70s and that sort of thing. And then he became a fellow of, then he was elected to professorship in Oxford. That carried with it the fellowship of New College. So somewhere in the 80s, he became a fellow of New College, stayed 2 years perhaps, and went to, I think, South Carolina, somewhere like this, somewhere in one of the southern states, where he wasn't particularly well, Louisiana perhaps, I don't know, where he wasn't particularly well treated, stayed in America until he may have come back to die in England. But anyway, he was a passing figure. Then we have Alexander. Then nobody, and the assumption was the Jews wouldn't be elected. I mean, Lasky, I'm sure, attributed his non-election to any fellowship, including also for that.
With justice?
Who can tell? 1912, I don't know. Yes, I should think it played a part. Then, yes, I mean, he was probably noisy and rebellious in his own way. I mean, he was sort of left-wing, no doubt, rather unsuitable sort of Manchester figure, but part of that, the fact is, Jew can't not have played about. Then, let me see, foreign name and all that. Then, Goodhart, who had an English-sounding name, who was an American Jew, was cousin of the Lehmans and the Morgenthaus, who was very rich, was a fellow of Corpus in Cambridge, and became Oxford as a professor of jurisprudence in 31. And his wife was not a Jew. What?
Philip?
His father.
His father.
It's called Arthur Goodhart. Right. His children are Church of England. Right. His wife was an Englishwoman, not Jewish. Right. He was not very anxious to talk about that sort of thing. He looked like 900 Jews. People always like that, always do. But after Hitler, he became more conscious and began not to publish reviews of Nazi books in the English Historical Review, which he was the editor. He adored English judges. He was adored in England by all judges. He was an Anglomaniac. He was frightfully sweet and extremely snobbish and very smooth and terribly enthusiastic about England. Simple-minded man. Died after the war.
So then there's Goodhart and then there's you?
Next year, I was made a Fellow of All Souls. The idea of a Jew at All Souls was sensational. To the Jews, that, well, I don't know what happened. There were three people elected that year. Wilberforce was now a retired judge, Lord Wilberforce. Patrick Riley was a retired diplomat, Sir Patrick Riley, me. Normally they elect two. This year for some reason they elect three. The Bishop of Gloucester did make a speech saying we are from a Christian foundation. Is it wise, is it right to elect a Jew? Right. That must have brought about 10 votes to my side. By then, sort of pro-Negro vote. You know what I mean? Probably. I mean, I knew nothing about it. My rivals, whom I defeated, I'm sorry to inform you of the election, were Freddie Eyre, Michael Gore Booth, who afterwards became head of the Foreign Office. Who else? One would have heard of. Oh, you wouldn't have known that. There's an eminent civil servant called Sir Frank Figgers. Tommy Hodgkin, who became a kind of left-wing Africanist. Member of the party.
Did that election proceed on the basis of you submitting a...
No, exam. Exam.
It was an exam.
Still is.
Uh-huh. Yes, I don't know anything about it.
Well, see, there's no thesis. You do an ordinary, straightforward exam. You choose the two subjects, law and history. By this time, philosophy had been added. But that's all. You either do law, there's a journal paper, there's an essay. Now there are two journal papers. Then you do two history papers plus another. Which now can be philosophy or politics. But in those days, philosophy was the only subject. No, I think economics had been added. That's why I did an economics paper, which was pure rubbish. And two philosophy paper, I think one philosophy paper, and essay and journal paper. And on the strength of that, and you are vivid. But the vivid was a torture then. You were to go into a room full of fellows, and you were given four unseens, Latin, Greek, German, French. These you read, whatever language you chose, and then translated straight away. It was mere torture. Well, I can't remember what language I did, probably German, maybe French. The warden of All Souls was Lord Chelmsford, who had been Viceroy of India, and was elected in 1931, and began to be warden in 1932, and died in 1933, after a very, very short period. And as I left the room after his wife, I heard him say, "Hope we don't have to have this one." Rather lowered my morale. I was made great fun. How when I came,
it was
wonderful. When I came, by the time I was asked for dinner, it was all right.
Yeah.
You see?
How quickly did you know?
I knew the day. I didn't know I was doing well. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was improving, no. Nobody said a word. But then Garon Maurice met me in the street on the morning after the election by pure accident. I was going to Blackwell's. He said, "Oh yes, you've been, congratulations, you've been elected." I said, "Not possible. Not possible. I never thought I would be. I never thought I'd be elected anything, really, in a way. I always thought I've done badly. They can see, like my lectures.
They can see through me.
Yes. It isn't genuine. It's all put on. It's all froth." And then, of course, I moved to All Souls 2 days later, which I did those days. The relief of leaving New College was enormous. Crossman was furious. Furious. I remember. Didn't like All Souls, didn't like my going there, the whole thing was a nuisance.
And thought he had you under his thumb.
Yes. And did, for a bit. And did. I'm just about to talk to a man, second man is writing his biography. Two biographies of Crossman are being written at this moment. One by...
That seems wretched excess.
I don't know. I wrote them even one, I think. No, perhaps not. One is an interesting man, Crossman. One is Tony Howard.
Yes.
He was writing one. The other is Dame Dayelle.
Oh my God.
This maverick figure.
Yes.
Who I think shared a house with him.
Yes.
Would have done, you know what I mean.
Yes. Right. So you were elected early 33?
Two.
32.
November 32.
Late 32.
November 32. I moved to Solsfeld in November 32, fell ill by December. Yeah. Sometime in December, fell ill for about a week, and then again, about mid-December 32, mm-hmm. was visited
why
by von Trott.
Why did you fall ill?
Because I went to bed too late and got up too early, and I mean, was so relieved leaving New College, I simply, I mean, talked all night to people.
Right.
And so on, you see, and played the radio, and all these wonderful concerts in Germany from the year. Those days, and particularly in the Nazi period, I could hardly go back to bed for 2:30, because the operas from Stuttgart and from Munich, which were broadcast, were of the most marvelous order. They started at midnight. Mm. Yeah. For some reason. It's a form of propaganda, I suppose.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, no, I feel ill because out of pure ill living, I'm so getting sleeping too little, really.
Yes.
And exhausting myself and talking too much, mm-hmm. all that sort of thing.
But you were in heaven?
In all sorts, absolutely. And then I went to Italy, because the doctor said I was going to sit in the sun. Just thought that Christmas time, my Malfi would be sitting in the whole sun.
Yeah.
And I did sit in the sun. It did cure me. I came back in about, I don't know, February,
right.
or so, 33.
Three.
I went on teaching New College till the war. That was all right.
You didn't need to live there and be
that's,
entombed.
Well, I went once a week. Once a week I used to get dinner there, and I felt very confident in mind who was there. I felt quite differently. If it was very boring, I wouldn't go into common room.
Yes.
So the common room every night. It isn't there.
Just before, you said it was in that period that
the great philosopher was a man called Joseph, mm-hmm. who was a very clever, sort of old-fashioned, Aristotelian teacher, everybody's teacher, vastly admired by everybody, not at all a nice man, in my opinion, who was quite polite to me, though he wasn't subversive in any way, real defender of vested interests, Winchester, New College, I mean every possible conservative doctrine, so to speak. Plato, Aristotle hated positivism, the new philosophy, and so on. And he taught Sparrow, taught Crossman, taught Herbert Hart. And they all thought he was marvelous.
But you didn't.
I did not. I wasn't like Freddie Hare, who thought he was odious and silly. That went rather far. No, no. Clever, he's a very good tutor. He was a very sharp, clever arguer. He produced a lot of very good solicitors, people said.
Mm-hmm. You said somewhere back there about 2 minutes ago, I have to catch you because you move so quickly, that was then when you met von Trott.
Oh, yeah, I suddenly produced von Trott's name. I met von Trott in 1931, in the, I would say, summer 31. I was in my fourth year in Oxford, ordinarily. No, I think earlier, even spring of 31. In the spring of 31, I was doing my school, there was second lot of schools. He was a Rhodes Scholar in Baylor. We met at lunch in Baylor, given by a friend of mine called Daniel Rumbold, who then became a foreign office official, a Romanian friend the rest of my life, Sir Anthony Rumbold Bart. And that's what he was. And he was there at lunch. He and I liked him very much.
What impression did he make on you, von Trott?
He was handsome, charming, infinitely agreeable, lots of charm, intelligent, friendly, and simply delightful.
And perfectly bilingual.
Perfectly bilingual. Well, with a German accent.
Yeah.
The English loved him. The highest compliment they used to pay was, you might be an Englishman. Mm-hmm. No better thing could be said to anyone.
Yeah.
Well, he was studying for them and whatnot, and we...
What was he studying?
PP.
He
originally came to Oxford, to Manchester College, Theological College, in about 27 or 28, that sort of year. And then got to know some people. Was a sort of theology student, curiously enough. That's when he met A.L. Rance, who fell in love with him and remained so, I think, for some time. It came to nothing. And...
von Trott was not an active homosexual.
No, he was not a homosexual at all. Wasn't at all. I mean, there's no reason thinking.
Yes.
Wasn't in any degree. but Rouse, of course, was and is, and writes about it.
Yes.
No secret. And then he went back to Germany.
In?
He went back to Germany probably in 28 or so, I don't know, 27 or 8. But then came back as a Rhodes Scholar.
Returned 31.
Well, no earlier than that.
30.
No, 3 years, I think. Must have returned in 30. Mm-hmm. I think in 30. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And I didn't meet him in his first year. And his great friend was and remained David Astor, mm-hmm. who adored him beyond more than anyone had ever adored anyone. Mm-hmm. He loved him intellectually, morally, spiritually, politically, in every possible respect, and still does. And worships his memory, he's an icon. If anyone has any criticism of him, as I'm apt to, I mean, on not very major matters, perhaps, it's enormously ill-received. He regards him as a traitor. I mean, can't talk to him.
Yes.
It's a fantastic domination.
Yes. What criticism can you remember launching
that
time
period later. Oh. At the time, I didn't.
Yes.
No, now we get into the Nazi period.
Yes, it's late.
Yes, you see, at the time, nothing. And then I thought, he's a very nice man. We agreed to meet again, always. At least, he said, do let's meet again. I said, only to please, or something. We then used to go walks in 31. And when we talk about philosophy, whenever he got into difficulties, any question I put to him, or then he would say, at this point, I fall back on Hegel, whom I hadn't read, and still haven't read, really.
But did he do that humorously or with serious intent?
Neither. It was sort of an ironical way out,
yes.
Like an acrobat,
yes.
With a net under him.
Yes.
If you have to fall, you fall into the net.
Yes.
He half meant it, yes.
Yes.
Yes, certainly. No, I think he believed in Hegel, all right.
Mm.
No, but the point is, he didn't say what it was. He didn't say, he says, or
yes.
The Hegelian way of putting it.
Yes.
He just said that, full stop.
Oh, I see.
Nothing further, not followed up. So you can say it sort of, it wasn't a joke. It was meant to say, look, this is too pedantic and too exact. I don't think in these terms.
Yeah.
And I think it's a larger way of thinking about these matters, which you in Oxford have no idea of.
Yeah.
So rather like that.
Yes.
Not contemptuous, but as a kind of defensive measure.
Where did these walks occur, do you remember?
In the parks, university parks in Oxford, Christchurch Meadow, Edison's Walk in Magdalen, everybody walked in those days.
Yeah.
Before the war. By about 2:30, we observed loud number of dons walking, never after.
Because
they all got married and had children and had to look after them and so on.
Yeah.
But you see, sort of academic walks are very frequent.
Yeah.
I met a lot of colleagues.
Yeah.
And chatted in the corners.
Yeah. Do you remember von Trapp talking about politics?
No, he did not talk about it. He was a Social Democrat. He was a member of the German Social Democrat Party. We didn't talk about politics any more than Burgess ever talked about politics to me. I was obviously clearly uninterested, shamefully so. I mean, I was on the whole liable to become a member of the Labour Party, which I did become. But all the same, I wasn't very political.
When people came to see you, they did not talk politics.
No.
You didn't give off those radiations.
No. I didn't tempt people to talk about politics. I wasn't the person to whom it was natural.
They just talk to you about philosophy. That would make you fearful.
Oh, no, we talk about literature.
Yeah.
We talk about literature, we talk about English. We talked about it. And then we had common friends. Our common friends were a girl called Sheila Granduff, whose letters to von Trott, or rather his letters to him, were just been published.
Yes.
She was a pretty girl whom Douglas Jay was in love with. He couldn't make up his mind between her and the lady he finally married. They both came to Small's Girls' School. She had a long, happy affair with Garon Maurice. Von Trott proposed to her on the park bench. In the university parks. Now that was a common friend. Then there was another girl called, I suppose Peggy Garnett, whom what's the name, Jay married. Then who else? Grand Maurice, part of that circle. It became a circle.
Yes.
Where we talked about each other.
Yes.
We met each other. There was a girl called Diana Hubbock, who became a mistress of von Trott, who's also written a book about all these things.
Yes.
The memoirs about von Trott are frequent.
Yes.
You see, so when you say, what did we talk about?
Yes.
Well, we talked about ideas,
yes.
Not philosophy technically, about ideas, about morals, but not politics, about German literature, which I didn't know very well. He was absolutely intoxicated by Kleist, who became a Nazi author, and whose collected plays he wrote in introduction.
Yes.
during the Nazi period, at some point. He talked about Kleist, he talked about Schiller, he talked about life in Germany. His father, who was a minister of education under the Kaiser. He talked about his brother, who was a communist. He talked about another brother, who was not. Right-wing, rather. He talked about his South African or British ancestors. I don't know, I just chatted away. Nothing particular. But he was very humorous, and very gay, that's right, in the non-modern sense, and full of spirits. And I think we talk about the news of the day.
Would you count him among one of your closest associates at that time, or somewhere in a sort of outer periphery?
An
inner periphery.
Yeah. He was a real friend. I remember when I fell ill in All Souls in 1932, Humphrey House was an eminent English critic in the later years, wrote this famous book on Dickens and edited Dickens and edited the Jesuit poet, you know what I mean, Hopkins. They came to call on me. They came to call on me when I was ill. And then when they remained outside in my outside room, they took a music stand, which is not mine, which had been there for some reason, put a mortarboard on it and a gown, dressed it up as a scarecrow, put a huge notice on it saying, "Don't enter." Well, that was a mood.
Yes.
But that's the sense in which I mean they were jolly. Not pompous, not serious. It wasn't grave, it wasn't tragic at all. Humphrey was already a Don, and what's name was not. But I mean, that kind of thing could be done in an outdoor room of newly elected fellow All Souls. It's fundamentally, there's a certain little frivolity about it.
Yeah. And that's what you adored about the atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I could talk about anything. And we sort of quite frequently. And then I can go on about von Trott, if you like, but
yes,
the rest of von Trott.
Yes.
Well, in 19, we were great friends. And let's say he was a social democrat and said he was. Then in 1933, he took examination in 32. He got second, I think. There are some letters by me to him, which were printed in his biography by Christopher Sykes, who didn't ask permission, which was wrong. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, the letters are very friendly, sentimental. Marlene didn't like them because she thought it looked as if I was homosexually in love with him. Mm-hmm. So that neither he nor I ever knew anything. You see? But anyhow, they're very friendly. And I advise him, I give him a description of mourning in All Souls. I'm sitting in this room. There's a terrible bore called Rouse talking away. It's that sort of thing, rather.
Yeah.
You see? And there's a man called Ricky who's trying to argue with him. And so on. He's quite driven. And I urged him to come in for All Souls, for the example, which he didn't do. So we must have been great friends.
Yeah.
That would have been late 32, I suppose. Autumn 32, I should think. No,
33.
Spring 33. He was still there. Or maybe no, anyhow. He went to Germany in February, March, I think, 33. Hitler was in power. And he came back, and a party was given for him by Collingwood, the philosopher.
By whom?
Collingwood.
Collingwood.
He was a famous Oxford philosopher at the time. And we all came. Von Trott was a man of many friends. He knew Cripps. He knew Master Beta Lindsay quite well. He knew Warden Adams also, as he got to know him. He knew the Astor family because of David.
Yes.
He knew Crossman. He met various conservatives, knew Halifax. He was a man who touched life in very great neighborhoods. He was handsome, aristocratic, and agreeable, why not? But he came back and we all said, what's going on? He said, my country is very, very sick. But no more. Didn't say it was terrible, or didn't talk about persecution, just said that. And then wouldn't talk to him. And then about a month, week later, went back, disappeared. We didn't know what he was doing. He was a lawyer, I think, technically, practicing law in Kassel, which is his family province, which is where he came from the Rhineland. Only Westphalia. Hesse he came from. nothing happened. I don't know. His Jewish mistress, Miss Habak, half-Jewish, he was going to stay with him, and he didn't show him allowed to be out in daytime for fear of, but in, at night time, they wandered the streets, I think. But still, she did come stay with him. And she's very, very, still very worshipful by him. Then in 1934, there was a man called Freddy Voigt, Voigt is the name really, but V-O-I-G-T. He was a Manchester Guardian correspondent, a very anti-Nazi, very brave, who wore a war wig and a false beard, penetrated places other people didn't go to, and wrote denunciations, wrote very true reports about the horrors, which was very in contrast to the Times, which of course didn't, for obvious reasons. And he described a law court at Kassel, which he said justice was clearly weighted against the Jews. It was not very surprising at that time. And a letter appeared by von Trott in the Manchester Guardian, saying, I am a lawyer working this court, and I can assure your readers that justice is absolutely scrupulous. This court in no kind of bias against the Jews has ever existed. Dr. Selby, the principal of Manchester College, which is this place he went to originally, then put a little thing underneath saying, Mr. von Trott is a very respectable and decent man, what he says should be believed. Well, I wasn't best pleased, I thought, well, maybe in Kassel there is perfect justice, but that's not the point. And the report wasn't intended for people interested in Kassel.
Yes.
And the impression was...
But the whole system was all right.
Not as bad as it would have been, yes. So I didn't know, so I complained.
Complained to whom?
To friends, common friends. Then David Astor, I think, wrote to von Trott, saying that Isaiah Berlin stabbed him in the back. No true friend. Was saying awful things about him, was complaining about him, saying he was trying to defend the regime. In 1936, within about 5 or 6, he came back to him, came to see me, said, well, maybe I shouldn't have written a letter. I mean, he exonerated himself, so we became friends once again. Anti-Nazi always was.
Okay.
Oh, that is no question. That's never in the least problem. Then he returned in 1937, I think, and said he was getting persuaded the Rhodes trustees, more particularly Lord Lothian, who became a friend, or typically, to send him to China. It cannot have been one of the intentions of Cecil Rhodes, sending Germans to China. But he went to China, God knows why, or to do what. He was a man who by this time was playing games. One didn't know what games. He was doing something, maybe pro, maybe anti-Nazi, maybe conspiracy, maybe not. One didn't know what was going on in a sense. One didn't like to ask. He went to China where Gough Booth told me certainly in the British embassy they assumed he was some kind of German agent. I don't think he was, but still. Never quite knew what he was up to. Something mysterious. Then, before he went to China, he was going through America. So I was asked by him to give him a letter of introduction to my friend Felix Frankfurter, which I did. So he was a very nice man.
And you met Felix Frankfurter because
in Oxford, because he was Eastern professor in 1933. And President Roosevelt later teased Frankfurter by being seen in company of a Nazi spy, because the FBI followed him by then. He wasn't, but nevertheless, he couldn't. Mrs. Frankfurter, who was a very perceptive lady, wrote me a letter saying, he's too handsome and too ambitious to be entirely trustworthy about him then. Then, in 1938, he came back to Oxford twice. He came back in the spring and saw me, saw everybody, came to dinner at Allsville because Sumner brought him, who was then not Warden, but was a fellow Belgian, and adored him like everybody else. And there was a man called Moltke, who was also killed in the plot, brought by Lionel Curtis. And they didn't appear to know each other, they really didn't. I couldn't bring myself to say, Freiherr von Trott, do you know Graf von Moltke?
A descendant of the great...
In German. Some way, I think so. Yeah. Certainly German. And he was very religious. He took part in the Kreisau conspiracy and was executed in 1944 like the others. He involved with the man who was going to be the chancellor, they succeeded, the mayor of... He was Hanover, what's his name, somebody, Gödel, or whatever, Merovitz, was the leader of the plot. Then, Pontrott said to me then, this is the last moment, unless Germany is surrounded and forced to, so to speak, to change its ways, it will be too late. He did say that. Then he came again in the autumn of 38, did not see me. May well have been unwise by then, as a Jew after all, so on. So Crossman, said if you saw Duncan Cairns, who later told me, he said to him, we will give Yugoslavia autonomy, which was not quite the same line of thought. But David then took him to stay at Clifton. And there's a letter from von Trott to von Weizsäcker, the father of the present president, who was in the German Foreign Office, which was discovered among the documents by the English after the war. I mean, it's part of the German documents published and so on, which he said, I'm staying in Clifton. Lord Astley is our man. He's very pro-German. He's a very man we must work with. So on, so on, so on. Now, Weizsäcker himself was a dubious Nazi. I mean, he didn't get into trouble. He was sent as ambassador to the Vatican. And he was, I think, knew the plotters. He managed to evade it. I don't think he was tried. May have been. But even the Nazis certainly thought he was sufficiently undisloyal, not to be touched. But so he was von Trott's obvious contact. By this time, I think von Trott was working in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But the letter was very compromising.
Yes.
So David Astor then had to do something. He looked as if he brought him into an appeasement nest.
Yes.
And business was being done.
Yes.
So Lady Cripps had to write a letter to the Magistrate Guard saying, Mr. David Astor is quite all right. And he has nothing to do with these things on defending him. That I remember. And
when did that happen?
Oh, after the war, well, I mean, when the documents are published. Well, much later than that. But they took their time to publish the document, volume 4. I mean. No, later than that. 50s. Yes. What?
Very simple.
Unbelievable. But von Trott. Quite an interesting story.
We are now in 38. He's been taken. Von Trott has been taken to Clifton by Astor and has written a rather incriminating letter.
Well, of course, what Astor believes is that he was on our side all the time. This is a mere cover.
Yes. Right. Whereas you had more doubts.
He had to do it. No, he didn't know it happened. I mean, I only saw it after he was dead, you see.
Yes.
The letter only appeared long after.
Yes.
Now I'll tell you what I think about it in a moment. But, he liked dangerous games, is the point.
Yes.
He played a game she lost. I mean, he was an anti-Hitler game.
Yes.
He was never in any way pro. That's fair enough.
Yes.
But what he did, God knows, he made complicated patterns.
Yes.
You know, but they didn't following. He wrote a letter to the Warden of All Souls, probably the Master Bailer too, saying if there is a war, and serious, it would be. He should like to probably march in the German army. That made a very good impression.